This is KXLU Los Angeles, 88.9 FM, and the program is Echo in the Sense. That's our public affairs show here at KXLU. I'm the host, Christine Palma, and tonight I thought it would be nice to get a little taste of the Conscious Life Expo, which happened this weekend at the LAX Hilton. It's a New Age event. We had psychics, we had yoga practitioners, we also had panels about what's going to happen in 2012, UFO phenomena, and tonight we have an interview with Peter Canova. He's the author of a spiritual thriller written as literary fiction, and Peter was part of the Conscious Life Expo. I hope you enjoy the program.
Before I became an author, I was actually in international business in luxury hotel development, and I had some experiences a number of years ago, a few decades ago, that really caused me to change the direction of my life, and ultimately it kind of culminated in me becoming an author and doing a lot of research and meditation on a variety of spiritual issues.
Intuitive, medical reading, psychic healing, all of those things, they just entered in your life?
Well, actually, what had happened was, I guess you could say that when I was younger, in my 20s, I was always a little bit of a seeker. I always felt that there had to be something a little bit more to life than what we see on the surface. And it led me to work with a group that was experimenting on developing a higher perception. And in the course of that, I found out I had a very clear facility to do intuitive medical readings. And I remember even the first one we did, and they were only allowed to give us the person's name, age, and address. And from that, I saw that the person had a heart problem. I saw something metallic at the bottom of the heart, which indicated to me he had a pacemaker, which he did. And they asked me what year was the pacemaker installed, and I saw the hands of a clock spinning around rapidly, and it stopped at 10 o'clock. And in my mind, that meant 10 years. So it was 1975 at the time, and I said, well, I think he had the pacemaker installed in 1965, and they said that that's correct. And then from there, I went on to do hundreds of medical readings for people. And what really changed my life about that was that I started to reflect on how am I able to get information like this. If I'm able to get information about what's going on inside of a person, both physically and emotionally, by just knowing their name, age, and address, and they're hundreds or even thousands of miles away from me, then we all must be connected by a greater energy. We must be part of a matrix of energy that we're all connected to. And that was a real revelation for me, and it led me on a spiritual quest for the rest of my life to find out about the nature of this connection and the things that bind us together at an unseen level.
So you're clairvoyant and intuitive?
Well, I've done all these things. I've done remote viewing. Yes, I've done clairvoyant and clairaudient and even psychokinesis, but I don't do any of that anymore. I stopped doing that years ago. The main reason being that I really had a desire to help people, and although the intuitive medical readings were helpful to people, there's a certain amount of immersion that happens to the person that's doing it. Now, unlike Edgar Cayce, who was asleep when he did these things, I was always conscious. So the emotions and the feelings and the other things surrounding these illnesses and these people and things like that, you know, it doesn't escape your consciousness. And cumulatively speaking, it gets difficult after a while. But besides that, I also felt that I wanted to reach a broader audience of people to share some of the spiritual insights that I'd had. And then I decided to take my love of writing and try and do something with it. And that's when I combined this spiritual wisdom that I had learned in the form of an entertaining novel.
The matrix that you were talking about earlier, so what confirmed that existed for you?
Well, it was no one thing that you can really put your finger on. It was really a whole series of things that happened over the course of my lifetime, but I can give you a few examples. Synchronicities just started happening in my life left and right. I mean, I would think of a person I hadn't seen in 30 years, and I would see them maybe half an hour later walking on a street in Boston. Then these synchronicities, these occurrences, were happening in such a way that I realized that they were like the chapters in a story. They were telling me things about my life and about the direction of my life, and the correlations became so clear. But there were other things, too. When I was traveling in a lot of exotic places, I would have people come up to me on the street that I didn't know, or on the street sometimes in Bangkok, Thailand, I'd have an Indian with a turban on and say, oh, a holy boy, and he'd come up and he'd start talking to me like he knew me. And this happened when I was in Africa. People that you would call bush doctors or shamans over there would approach me from out of nowhere and start talking to me as if they knew I had already had these spiritual issues in my mind. These things even saved my life on a couple of occasions. One time when we were in Africa, I worked there for about 3 years in Nigeria, and it was a very dangerous place at the time. And we were supposed to take a plane to fly from one city to another, but as happened almost all the time there, the plane didn't fly. It was canceled. So we were going to take a taxi and do about an 8-hour drive from this one town to another. And just before my associate and I were going to get in the taxi, I just had almost like a hand pulling me back out of the taxi. And I had this strong premonition that we should not get in there. And he said, well, what are you, crazy? We've got an appointment. We can't break this appointment. I said, I don't care. I said, you want to go? I said, but I wouldn't recommend it. I said, I'm not going. So I suggest you not go. We found out a couple of days later that that same taxi had picked up some other Europeans to go to that city. And they were killed by brigands on the road on the way over there, which was not uncommon in Africa. There was a lot of these guys kind of roaming these back roads in Africa, or at least Nigeria at the time. But these are a couple of examples.
Okay, you believe that spirit transcends the religious beliefs that tend to divide people. Can you speak to that?
Well, I do, because I always say that prophets speak the heart of God, but followers start religions, because the followers of prophets have never really had the personal experience of touching the divine. They don't have firsthand knowledge of that power and that intelligence and that energy that the prophet or the sage has touched. And that being the case, they now start to get into interpreting what the prophet meant and what the prophet said. And when you start to get into interpretation, there's a vacuum there, and the vacuum leaves room for agendas and power struggles. So institutional religion usually ends up becoming pretty dogmatic and restricting over a period of time, and that's what's happened to almost every major religion in the world today. You know, that original spark of revelation from the prophet itself starts to become institutionalized and interpreted, and creeds and dogmas and other things develop. But the pure inspiration of spirit itself is something quite different, and it's almost something that I believe every person has to experience individually. And that's why I really got into the field that I did and got into writing, because I had had these experiences of touching this higher energy and this higher consciousness and intelligence, and it was very transformative in my life. And I wanted to help other people get there and make them realize that my experience is not unique. I think everybody has the ability to do this. It's really a question of having the desire and the motivation and a little bit of the knowledge and faith to begin with. But then at some point you go beyond faith and you go into knowledge, because faith is something you have to take as a proposition hearing from somebody else. Knowledge is when you've had direct experience of something, and there's a world of difference. So what I'm really trying to do is kind of get people along that road to graduate from faith to knowledge, and that's what I do in my books.
Are there any modern-day prophets?
I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who are in different stages of enlightenment. I don't consider myself a prophet. I don't even consider myself an enlightened person. I consider myself a person who has had glimpses of enlightenment. And I think that we're a part of a conscious chain of being. Behind this physical body that we identify with us, I think there are multiple levels of ourselves, which are multiple levels of spiritual consciousness. And the higher you move up that ladder or that chain of consciousness, probably the information comes in with greater clarity. And I believe we all have those abilities. So I have no doubt that there are people out there who have helpful information to share with other people. If you want to call those people prophets, that's fine. I think I tend not to put the labels on that. There's certainly people out there who have revelations, and I think the only thing that I would caution is, I guess I'm not a big believer in being a follower. I'm a believer in being a leader, and I'm not speaking about myself personally. I'm speaking for all of us in that regard. So if you want to have a spiritual experience in your life, I think you have to be a leader and take responsibility to get to the point where you don't really have to rely on somebody else. Take what help you can, absorb things that other people have to say, but never take anything as the final word, because the one thing I realized in this life is every time I think I've had an absolute truth, I realize in the end it was a relative truth, and I'm not really sure there's any such thing as absolute truth in this material plane. The absolute truth is really God or you know, the Supreme Being, and you know that once. It's kind of like the old Supreme Court case, you know it once you see it. But I really think that people taking responsibility for their own spiritual growth is very important, and any spiritual teacher or person that encourages you to do that, I think is genuine. If they're willing to push your ship out to sea and give you that little push or nudge to get your sails up, then there's something there. If they basically say, you know, I am the boat, I'm the only one you can sail on to get where you want to be, I'd be a little bit wary.
So how does this struggle or this taking on of the responsibility of your own spiritual growth, how does that relate vis-a-vis the modern world?
Well, I'm not even necessarily sure if it has anything to do with the modern world. I think that one thing that has prevented people from growing spiritually goes all the way back to the Bible, let's say, or even beyond, when you remember Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden to till the earth by the sweat of their brow. Well, to me, what that meant was that one of the things that has happened to humanity is that we've forgotten our spiritual origins, because we have become so fixated in surviving in a material world that, you know, you're worried about putting bread on the table, getting the kids through college, not getting fired at your job. And of course, back in ancient times, or, you know, prehistoric times, it was even worse, because you were worried about getting eaten by a saber-toothed tiger. So I think when consciousness first descended from the higher planes to embody in physical form, one of the early things that it would probably have to deal with is all of a sudden this consciousness that was once not tied to form, but was a pure form of energy, now found itself in a rather harsh and dangerous environment, and it had to start developing what you call like certain male oriented faculties of logic, analysis, and things to survive. Now in the modern age, those faculties have gotten, in consciousness movement or pejoratively speaking, New Age movement, have gotten kind of a bad rap as being logic, analysis, everything else. But to tell you honestly, humanity would have been devoured at one point in history if they had not developed those faculties. The problem is the scales have gone really far in another direction. So if we descended from pure consciousness, we've gone kind of in the opposite direction to get into survival mode. And I think maybe the tale of the modern age is bringing it back into balance, bringing that feminine intuitive feeling side of us back into balance with this logical male analytical side that sort of helped us survive in a physical world, to become a superior human being and use all those faculties. So we are both physical and we're spiritual.
The struggle to survive in a material world, does that come first? Do you have to take care of that first before you can tackle your spiritual responsibility?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure it's a chicken-egg situation, but you certainly can't neglect one in favor of the other, at least if you want to lead a whole and a complete life. I've never been one who subscribed to being so holy that you spend all your life in a cave meditating by yourself. I mean, I know that's been a path for some people, and I know solitude is good for periods of time in order to get away from the clutter and to reach your inner self. But I also do believe that we're here for a purpose. We were born into this physical body for a purpose, and we have something to give ourselves, and we have something to give one another. And so I think at some point you have to come out of the cave and express what you've learned, maybe as a guide to help other people, which is kind of what I do with my books. I guess that's my way of dealing with that question. I think both are important. You have to be practical. You are in a physical body. You need to work, and at least most of us need to work and make money in order to get along in this world. But if we so fixate on that to the detriment of our spiritual lives, and we have such a gap in there, we end up being very unhappy people. And collectively speaking, it's the cause for a lot of insanity in the world. Having a spiritual void and being so fixated on the material, is the scales go in the other direction, and then it opens up a whole new set of problems.
Okay, we will talk about Pope Annalisa. What other books do you have out?
Well, Pope Annalisa is actually my first novel. I've written several other short stories which have won literary prizes, but I've never really published those. I had a short story on Francis Ford Coppola's American Zoetrope online, which took first place out of 500 entries, and I won a first literary prize at a Santa Barbara's Writers Conference a few years ago for a short story that I'd done. But Pope Annalisa is my first published work, and I'm currently working on the sequel to Pope Annalisa. It's actually a trilogy called The First Souls Trilogy. trilogy, Pope Annalisa being the first book. And the second book is called The 13th Disciple. And that book is a continuation of Pope Annalisa. It deals with the characters in the first book, but in previous lives, in previous incarnations, and that were formative incarnations for the people that they've become in Pope Annalisa. And it deals a lot with the lost Christian spiritual teachings, the lost women of the Bible, and Mary Magdalene. And Mary Magdalene is, of course, the 13th disciple.
So it's interesting. What genre would you say that this falls under, but it's a literary fiction?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. I sort of had to invent a term for this called spiritual thriller. And the thing about it is it's a real crossover book. It's a rare work where it could be read by somebody who's spiritually clueless, but they're just looking for a good, exciting read, and they'll get a lot out of the book. But it's also something for people who are very metaphysically oriented, and they get a whole nother subtext out of the book itself. And the wonderful thing is that I very consciously crafted the book to be like that. It was very difficult to do because, on one hand, you don't want to write a boring spiritual tome that kind of kills the commercial readability of the book. On the other hand, you don't want to make the book so commercial that there's no content, there's no really spiritual or intellectual content to it. So it was kind of a tightrope I had to walk, but it seems like it succeeded because in all the reviews that I get on Amazon or from other places, it seems like a really good mixture between men and women reading the book and between people who are spiritually oriented and people who just like a good read.
Pope Annalisa, let's set the time and place.
Yeah. Pope Annalisa is set in the near future world of 2025, and it's kind of a bleak world. The resources, water, oil, and other natural resources that we take for granted today have dwindled and are getting rather scarce, and great nations are competing for these limited resources. And we find America as an overly ripe economy that never completely kicked its oil habit, and it's almost like a semi-permanent state of depression. Terrorism is running rampant. American and European cities are being bombed, and the relations between the West and the Islamic world have reached a very dangerous flashpoint. Iran has also gone nuclear in this book, and incidentally, just an interesting aside, you're talking about some of these psychic phenomena. When I first wrote this book, this was before the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein in Iraq, I decided, well, I'm going to make the plot backdrop for this book, an American invasion of Iraq against Saddam Hussein. And then, lo and behold, that happened. And I said, okay, well, let me shift this a little bit, and we'll have a second Gulf War with Saddam Hussein's sons involved. And then, then that happened, and I said, okay, all right, now let me develop a whole new thing. We'll get out of Iraq, and we'll go to Iran, and Iran developing a nuclear weapon. Well, we know what happened with that. So after a while, the book got so predictive of current geopolitical events, I said, I'm not writing it anymore. It's going to press just as it is. But Iran has gone nuclear in this book, and it's a very troubled world. Then all of a sudden, this nun in Africa starts making waves with these incredible healings that she's performing, and she comes under suspicion of the Catholic Church because there's a body of prophecies that warns against a great deceiver, a great destroyer, who will fool everybody and essentially lead the world order to ruin, destroy the Catholic Church, destroy the Church and lead the world order to ruin. So they're investigating her. There's a very strong resentment against her in the Catholic Church, but through a sort of ironic series of events, she ends up healing the current pope after he has a serious stroke. She ends up with an almost instantaneous healing of him, and that leads to a whole chain of events where she's brought into the church itself as the first female cardinal and then ultimately the first female pope. And I won't give away the book on how that happens, but from that point on, the world goes to hell in a handbasket because when she does become the pope, the Catholic Church breaks apart. The America and Iran actually started a war that's just about to go nuclear. It looks like the people who were always wary about her are correct about her. And the interesting thing about this is that throughout most of the book, probably three quarters or more of the book, it's not clear to the reader what her agenda is. It's not clear whether she's going to be a force for good or savior of the world, or whether she's the source of the problem, that the one who's who's causing this and fanning the flames.
What was your decision to make her from Africa, to make her black?
It was several things. First of all, as I said earlier, I lived in Nigeria for 3 years, so I was very familiar with that culture and that setting. And in Africa, they still have a strong current of animism, which is the native religion over there, even in Christian Africa. There's still elements of that. And it is a type of religion that's much more feminine, oriented towards the earth and rhythm with the earth and so forth. And I thought that that was a really interesting distinction to all the sophisticated theology and dogma of the Catholic Church. So, you know, it was a real juxtaposition between where Annalisa, the Christianity that she's practicing, and she comes out of, and she's up against all these men in the Catholic Church. She's a lone woman up against all these men, and there are thousands of years of sophisticated, convoluted dogmas and so forth. So I thought that was one interesting juxtaposition. Of course, being a woman, I think, sort of speaks for itself. She's the first woman to break into a 2,000-year-old men's club, probably the most exclusive men's club in the world, when she gets admitted into the cardinalate of the church. Finally, I think that one of the other things I wanted to demonstrate was that spirit can speak through the most unlikely people in the most unlikely circumstances. Spirit is no respecter of people or religions or anything else. Spirit can speak to us through any form, at any age, at any time.
Well, so you have a Malthusian view of the future, shortages. Do you believe that?
Not necessarily. I believe it could be like that. We as human beings have an infinite power to change and change the course of event depending upon our current actions and depending upon the beliefs that we have and the energy we put into those beliefs. I don't think that the type of world I'm describing in Pope Annalisa is inevitable. It's certainly a possibility. It's certainly one possibility. If we make good choices now, we can avoid problems down the road.
Did you write this in first person or third person?
No, this was written in the third person. I wrote it in third person primarily because I wanted to have this woman viewed through the lens of other people. Think about it for a second. If you take a look at Jesus of Nazareth, think about what people must have thought about him during his ministry. I mean, some people probably thought he was a troublemaker. Some people thought he was a sorcerer. Other people thought he was a divine incarnation. And other people thought he was a blasphemer. You have a whole spectrum of opinion around great people. And it's not always clear. Like I said in the book, it's not always clear whether Annalisa is, you know, is going to be helpful or destructive in terms of what she's doing. And I think that's the way it is around many great figures. People read things differently. They read into things differently. I wanted to have all those kind of perspectives going on to develop the character of Annalisa as opposed to revealing too much information too soon inside of her head.
So whose point of view is it filtered through? Who's the narrator?
There is no one narrator. It's a little bit omniscient, but the story is primarily told through the lens of several other major characters. Now, the book is called The First Souls, and they're around Annalisa. There are other people who, I mean, maybe I should go back and explain The First Souls for a second. The First Souls are actually the first spirits, the first intelligence to incarnate into the physical world from the dimension of pure consciousness. And the trilogy traces their incarnations over different epochs of human history. So their story is really our story. The story of the first souls is really the story of humanity. It's the story of our origin, our purpose, and our destiny on earth. And as they live out their lives, the revelations that they start to learn about Annalisa starts to open up revelations about themselves and about what their destiny is and what the destiny of all of us as human beings are. It's really up to these other characters. There's about four of them in Pope Annalisa. There are a close circle around Annalisa who are discovering her and what she's about. What's the secret of this Pope? She does carry a secret. And these four people kind of racing against time. They're racing against the nuclear clock of a confrontation between America and Iran and the world just, you know, going into annihilation to sort of find out what she's all about, because what she's about is really what the kind of the way the world is going to go and what the whole thrust of our existence is about. So it's seen primarily through the prism of those other major characters.
What is our purpose here in life?
I have speculations in the book about what that is, and I don't like to state anything definitively, but what I will say is that our purpose really ties in with the fact that there's actually two ways of viewing a human being, the one of traditional religion and the other through the lens of this universal spiritual tradition that I discuss in the book. And that's something that through my meditations and through my research, I saw that there's spiritual threads that have connected just about every major religion, pagan and modern, that ever was, with a certain common wisdom and knowledge that's over time it's been obscured or almost lost to us. And the fundamental difference between that spiritual wisdom and what we have been told in our Judeo-Christian heritage is that we are not separate from God as Christianity would tell you. Christianity would say that, well, human beings, and Judaism would say that human beings were kind of these lumps of clay and God breathed life in them and then we went ahead and sinned and now we're spending the rest of our lives trying to atone for that sin and gain God's grace back. Whereas the spiritual wisdom tradition basically said there is no separation between God and humanity. God has projected its essence out into several dimensions, the lowest of which is physical existence, but God's essence is within everything that is, including the human consciousness. Now, we don't remember that, we don't recognize that, and the reason they said that that condition exists is that the further spirit projected itself out from its center, the more it became ignorant of its own nature. And it gets a little complex, because that ignorance had to do with the fact, and the listeners have to think about this for a second, if something is everything, how does something that is everything start to think of itself as something? How does it start to think of itself as a separate identity? So how does something that encompasses everything start to think of itself as a separate identity or identities? The answer to that is through ignorance and through forgetting. And the Hindus have a very astute saying that summarizes this, which is that this earth is God's playground for forgetting himself. Only by spirit projecting itself out to the point where it would forget its true source, can it think of itself as something separate and unique, as you, as me, as separate individual identities. And the other best way I can clarify that to the listeners is, think about this for a second. You have like a CD, and you start to make copies of it. With each successive copy of the CD, you lose just a little bit of clarity and you lose a little bit of resolution. Well, think of that whole thing as spirit projecting itself on down the line. Each projection of spirit further on down has a little bit less clarity and resolution about its original source. And it's that lack of clarity and lack of resolution that forms individual identity. Because if we all had ultimate consciousness, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be talking to you and you talking to me and us thinking of each other as separate beings. We'd know we were one. It's this forgetting that gives us experience as separate identities, and yet the core of ourselves is still a unity. The core of ourselves is still the one projecting itself as many.
Well, another way of asserting identity is to abject parts of yourself or reject parts of yourself. So do you think maybe these things at the fringes are parts that are rejected?
Well, I think it's a little bit semantical here, because rejection is really the same thing as what I was saying about ignorance or forgetting. It's really one and the same. In a way, we rejected a consciousness of one to embrace a consciousness of many. Or another way of saying that is, I think we probably had an agreement amongst ourselves at some point that we would reject the remembrance of a part of our being in order to feel like we were separate identities, if that makes sense. It can get a little bit complex when you start to think of this one and many. It really, whether you call it rejection, whether you call it ignorance or whatever, it's all about having a little bit less clarity from the source that we projected ourselves in. And that means shadow. Ignorance is shadow. Ignorance of our supreme consciousness, of our consciousness of wholeness, is really shadow. So we're all creatures of light and shadow, because as long as you have a separate identity, you have a little bit of shadow in you. You've forgotten to some extent where you come from. And enlightenment really means the degree to which you recapture that consciousness of oneness. That's when you become enlightened. You're recapturing the light again. So we kind of go from pure light energy down to the state we are, which is ego consciousness, and then through spiritual growth, we enlighten, work our way back to remembrance or the knowledge from the place that we came.
Are we on a treadmill where we plod along towards this goal? Or is there a clock ticking where we have a limited amount of time to accomplish this?
I think clocks and time are totally a concept of the material world. In the higher dimensions, what we perceive as time, which allows us to, you know, live in the illusion of a material world, doesn't really exist at the level of pure light or pure consciousness. No, there's no time limits on anything.
I was told you're also a Gnostic expert. Are you?
Well, I have read a lot of and thought about a lot of the Gnostic material. I've read the Gnostic, and actually even in the original Greek, I've read some of the texts. So I have studied the Gnostics, because they kind of like Carl Jung. When he first discovered the Gnostic text, he He said it was like, I finally found a circle of friends who understood me. And I kind of felt the same way reading the Gnostic texts. All the things that I'd had personal experiences with and I'd learned, when I started to read these ancient texts, it was kind of like astounding. It was, other people have gone through this. And the interesting thing about it was that Gnosticism was probably the original Christianity, this universal spiritual tradition that I talked about earlier. The Gnostics were a continuation of that, as I think Jesus was. Jesus was a continuation in the Western world of this universal spiritual tradition, teaching this spiritual wisdom. It was a kind of a quirk of history that Christianity, there were really two Christianities. There was the Christianity of the outer church, or the public sermons, the Sermon on the Mount and so forth, which later evolved into the Catholic Church. And then there was the inner mystical church, which unfortunately was destroyed by the outer church. If you want to, we can get into a little bit of the history of that. Gnosticism.
Yeah, can you summarize just a little bit for listeners who don't know what the Gnostic texts are?
Gnostics were a group of mystics that had been around for thousands of years, even before Christianity. And they were the practitioners of this ancient spiritual tradition that I spoke about, and had some of this knowledge of God and spirit, which we've spoken about previously. They were the first Christians, but they were ultimately persecuted by what became the Orthodox Church, Orthodox Catholic Church, and their writings were burned, and many of them were burned, unfortunately. In 1945, they made a fantastic discovery in the deserts of Egypt, and they recovered a cache of Gnostic Gospels that shed a whole new light on Christianity.
The Dead Sea Scrolls?
No. These are the Nag Hammadi Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels. The Dead Sea Scrolls is something entirely. Those weren't Christian. They were more of the Jewish tradition. Okay. We had glimpses of the Gnostics and what they believed previously only through their enemies in the Orthodox Church. Mm-hmm. The bishops like Irenaeus, the Orthodox Bishop of Lyon, France, back in the second century, wrote a book called Against All Heresies, and he described the practices of the Gnostics in there. But then again, of course, you were getting his version of it, and he was one of the ones who, you know, persecuted the Gnostics. But this was original source material that we discovered in 1945, and it was just a fantastic find. And over a period of time, my personal belief is it will change our spiritual understanding and change the face of Christianity over a period of time. It always takes a long time for these things to become mainstream and public. But when Christ, Jesus, started to preach in Palestine, the Gnostics embraced Jesus probably because they recognized in him a continuation of their own universal spiritual teachings. So the Gnostics really became the first Christians. This spiritual tradition was also in Judaism and Islam. It was the Kabbalah in Islam. It was Gnosticism in Christianity. And it's the Sufis in Islamic religion. And the Sufis and the Kabbalah survive even into today. Unfortunately, the Catholic Church was meticulous in destroying the Gnostics, and it was a real tragedy because the spiritual wisdom that we lost, and not just the spiritual wisdom, but the psychological insights into human nature that Carl Jung saw in the Gnostics that was so fantastic, we lost all of that knowledge when they destroyed the Gnostics. Hopefully in the future we'll discover more texts, and we know that there were quite a few, and the majority of them are probably destroyed, but maybe a few of them are still lying in the sands out in the Middle Eastern desert somewhere.
That primary source material, what language was it written in when they finally went from oral tradition to writing their philosophies down?
Several different languages, primarily Coptic and Greek. Coptic was the language of Ethiopia, ancient language of Ethiopia, and it was based upon Greek. It used Greek words that were mixed in with the native language at the time. Fortunately, we can translate Coptic and also Greek, and a smaller number, very small number, may have been written in Aramaic, which is the language that Jesus used, but it was primarily Coptic and Greek that they were written in.
So why don't we expand a little bit further on the two Christianities?
It's evident from the Bible itself, and from writings of early church fathers like Clement of Alexandria, the Bishop of Alexandria, that there were two teachings of early Christianity. One was given to the masses, but in Matthew and Mark and other places, Jesus said unto them, you know, I give parables, but unto you I give the mysteries. And he was talking to the disciples. So Jesus was teaching one thing to the masses and another thing to the disciples and to the, let's say, spiritually mature. Reason for that? Well, think about it for a second. Spiritual mysteries are complex because they get really into the deepest mysteries of life. Who are we? Why are we here? And so forth. not everybody's cut out to receive those and understand them or even to be interested in them to begin with. It was always easier to have a certain type of teaching for a mass audience, and especially back in those days when, you know, you're talking, most people were illiterate peasants. They didn't have the level of education that we had today, so these mysteries were things that might have been very difficult for them to understand. And yes, they were tilling the earth, literally speaking, and how much time did they have to devote to studying these things? There was a series of academies all around the ancient world called mystery schools, and they stretched from India to Persia to Egypt and the Middle East. And some of the a famous one would have been, for instance, the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece that taught at Delphi, and there were a number of other mystery schools, but they essentially taught the same spiritual wisdom tradition. And you could think of them as like an Ivy League of spiritual teaching. They had initiates go through stages of initiation into the spiritual mysteries, because the spiritual mysteries is not something you can sit down and you can explain in 10 minutes and then somebody's enlightened. I mean, think of the Indian gurus and how much, you know, the yogis and how much time, you know, they spend in practice and meditation, you know, before they start to transform their consciousness. So this is a process, and, you know, of weaning you away from your everyday consciousness into getting you to, you know, used to getting you into higher levels of perception. So they'd had to do this in stages. Christianity was probably structured in much the same way. So you had the outer church, and then you have the church of the inner mysteries, and it was probably set up something like the Freemasons are today. You know, there's the, like 32 degrees of masonry, and at each degree you're given more, exposed to more and more of the secrets and so forth. Christianity was probably very much like that. Christianity struggled against the oppression of the Roman Empire. The outer church said, hey, the only way we're going to stop these persecutions is essentially by getting accepted by Rome. And they were competing with a number of other religions. Of course, society back then, Roman and even Jewish society, was very male-oriented, very patriarchal in character. And the early Christian movement, because it involved so many intuitive and creative aspects of mysticism, was rather feminine in orientation. And there were a lot of females, Mary Magdalene and others, who were the real leaders of the church back then. But as Christianity, as the outward form of Christianity, tried to gain acceptance by Rome, it was an embarrassment to have so many women around. So they systematically started pushing the women out of the church, getting rid of their writings or altering their writings to make it look like it came from men rather than women. It's a really good article by a guy named Ramon Jacino, who has speculated that the Gospel of John was actually originally the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and he makes a very strong argument for it. But it's clear that the process went on over the second and third centuries of Christianity, where they were gradually moving the women out, until finally, in 325 AD, the Roman Emperor Constantine said, hey, you know what? We can get Christianity in a form where I can use this as a tool to control my empire. There's no better way to control people than through religion. And he basically had an all-male cast of bishops that he kind of put into a room at sword point. And he said, okay, we're going to develop a creed for Christianity that everybody has to believe in. And if you don't believe in this, you're going to get in serious trouble. And that was the Council of Nicaea. And that's where the first written forms of Orthodox Christianity started to crystallize. And they said, essentially, there's only one way of belief. Now, after that happened, it was open season of the Gnostics and the mystics, and they said, you know, well, we can't have people going around teaching that God is inside everybody, and you have to go into yourself because the kingdom is within, which is what Jesus said. Because if that's the case, you don't need bishops, and you don't need a church, and you don't need a Roman emperor. You can do those things yourself. So it became clear that why these people were a threat, and over a period of time, they were exterminated, and their writings were either altered or destroyed.
What's your source for coming up with the role, and I guess the role of Mary Magdalene?
We don't have a lot of primary sources for Mary Magdalene. To tell you the truth, we don't have a lot of primary sources for Jesus either, historical sources, actual written records of a historical Jesus. And we have even less for Mary Magdalene. We do know some things from her in the Bible. Her and the other female disciples helped support Jesus and the other disciples. So chances are they were women of means. The implication is they were probably educated and they came from families, well-to-do families. Mary may likely have come from the fishing village of Magdala on the Sea of Galilee, which was a very prosperous fishing village. She could have come from a well-to-do family with a certain amount of education, as, you know, they would have given women back then. We also know that she was one of the few disciples who remained during the crucifixion when the men fled. She was there with Mary the mother. Probably the most significant aspect of her in the Bible is she was the first one to see the risen Jesus. And they call her the apostle to, even the Catholic Church calls her Apostola Apostolarum, which is the apostle to the apostles. And she's venerated in the Catholic Church for being the first one to see the risen Jesus. But you really get the sense in the Bible, all throughout the Bible, and this is really kind of intuiting, you kind of get the sense that Mary's role and the role of the other women, it's like looming there in the background, but it's almost like someone's cast a veil over it. Like she was so important, they couldn't completely get rid of her, but they watered her down to a great extent. Now, we get a much more clear picture of her in those Gnostic Gospels that were recovered in 1945. She was portrayed as Jesus' companion, very much, very prominent. She was portrayed as Jesus' companion, that he kissed her frequently, which outraged the other disciples, and they thought it was scandalous that he showed her this kind of physical affection. She understood his mystical teaching so well that she actually helped formulate questions to draw Jesus' teachings out to benefit the understanding of the other disciples. So she was almost like an understudy of Jesus as far as speaking about these mysteries. The Gnostics, actually, many Gnostics, sects of Gnostics, actually held her to be an incarnation of the Holy Spirit, just the way that Jesus was an incarnation of the Son, that she was the incarnation of the Holy Spirit, and that two of them together, their collective teachings together, were the male, the word, or the sort of intellectual analytical side, and the female, or the intuitive female side, that coming together and using both those faculties could allow people to learn and grow, and that was embodied in the person of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So there was an intimate relationship within there, and I'm not talking about sexually intimate. Dan Brown's book kind of gets into that whole thing about Jesus and Mary having children. To me, it's totally immaterial. I mean, it maybe not, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but in Dan Brown's book, she was the Holy Grail, meaning she was the receptacle of his children. In my book, she's the Holy Grail, being the receptacle of his lost knowledge, of his secret knowledge. And to me, that gives her much more power than just being a house mom.
How long are the Gnostic texts? Is it?
I pity anybody that tries to read those in the original form, unless you're somebody like me that has a really great interest in this thing. And you know, I do speak Greek. Fortunately, I spoke Greek, so that was a big help in interpreting some of the meaning behind some of the words. If you read them in their original form, you would not understand them. What I would really suggest, if anybody is really interested in understanding the Gnostic Gospels, I'd start off with secondary sources. I'd go to certain scholars like Elaine Pagels, who is a professor at Princeton University, or Stefan Heller, who is another scholar, and he's actually a Gnostic bishop who lives here in Hollywood in the L.A. area. And there's a couple of other writers like them. They will help decipher the context and some of the meaning behind the Gospels themselves. Because a direct reading of the Gospels, it's very complex stuff. And unless you have a lot of background information to decode what this meant in the time and the place that it was written for, you'll probably go away scratching your head reading the original texts.
Well, so obviously the church dismisses this, the Gnostic text, right?
It's heresy. Yeah, I mean, it's considered heretical. Although the scuttlebutt I get from seminaries and from some Catholic priests is that there's a growing interest in Gnosticism. Now, they probably would disguise that in a Catholic context as having an academic interest in Christian history, you know, because it's heretical to a Gnostic viewpoints. This whole concept of called emanationism, it's banned as heresy by the Catholic Church. And emanationism is what we spoke about before, which is that human beings are the projections of God's spiritual essence. In a whole spiritual chain of being down into the spirit and body, whereas in Christianity they said no, that's not how it is. You know, that's blasphemy to say that, you know, we're of the same essence as God. We were these, you know, kind of separate little wind-up dolls that God created, and then we went ahead and sinned, and now we're looking to get back into God's good graces. So very basic Gnostic concepts are considered heresy by the Catholic Church.
Can you compare it to quantum physics, these sorts of principles?
Well,
maybe emanationism.
A close reading and understanding of the Gnostic Gospels has incredible parallels to so many findings or theories in modern quantum physics. For instance, when the first thought of separation occurred in the spiritual realm, the thought of separate identity as opposed to the thought of unity, the thought of a spirit thinking it was a spirit instead of thinking it was God, if you understand that, that whole focus, taking focus off the unity and putting focus on individual identity, led to a chain reaction that led to the development of materiality, the material world. And that the material and the spiritual could not coexist in the same vibration or the same dimension. And the world of matter was expelled in a great disturbance. If you take account of the fact that they didn't have technical language and they didn't have particle colliders and quantum theory back in those days. This is a description of the Big Bang. The Gnostics said that there were 10 or more dimensions of spiritual intelligence, and that one of these dimensions that became the physical was expelled in a great disturbance, which is exactly what string theory and the Big Bang say. We had 10 or more dimensions crunched down into three in an explosion in a great disturbance called the Big Bang, and it was the beginning of matter and time. Very similar description in the Gnostic Gospels. Parallel universes, the fact that we have co-dimensions of physical and non-physical dimensions and things is all throughout the Gnostic Gospels. That's what the parallel universe theory says in quantum physics today. I mean, the list goes on. Holographic theory, which is that we are projections of intelligent information from a two-dimensional space into our three-dimensional world, which is what David Bohm and some others have said was the basis for the movie The Matrix, that we're living in an illusion, a holographic illusion, like think of the old holodeck on Star Trek, okay? That's the best analogy that I can give. This is what the Gnostics were saying. The Gnostics were saying that these spirit intelligences blanketed the material world and projected, and they were responsible for controlling or projecting different information that would constitute the material world. This is an exact duplicate of what holographic theory is saying, which is that information coming sort of from outside is projected into this dimension that we know as physical and informing and instructing it and guiding it along. So the list goes on, but if you, like I say, if you take away the fact that they didn't have technical language, what they did have was the language of myth. So many of the Gnostic texts are in the forms of myths, but myths should not be taken as meaning fantasies and just a lot of baloney. Myth, well, the creation myth, for instance, the Gnostics had a pretty elaborate creation myth where a female deity was the one who decided that she wanted to create in the way that God creates, but she did it by herself. She did it instead of doing it in the normal pattern of creation, which is what the unity would have done. She broke with the unity and acted on her own, and the chain reaction of that led to the creation of the material world. Of course, that sounds like a myth, just like Greek myths are and everything else. But if you compare the myths, which are symbolic languages or archetypical symbolic pictures that they tried to present for people, those pictures, like Plato's, shadows in the cave, the shadows are the illusion that we have of what the material world is. The real pictures come from another source. So in these myths, we get these projections that look fantastic, but if you look and dig in back of the myths, you come up with these archetypical truths that you can find these creation stories in all the cultures of the ancient world. Similarities from India to Sumeria to Persia. Flood story would be one thing like that, but along that line. So we should never say myth is fantastic stories with it which have no basis in reality. They definitely have a basis in reality. It may not be completely the reality that we know in terms of physical reality, but it's the reality that underlies physical reality. That's the basis for our physical reality.
I think we're going to end on that note. If you've joined us late, or if you listened to the whole thing, again, this is Christine Palma with Peter Canova. Peter Canova, Canova. He's written his first book in a trilogy called Pope Annalisa. The genre would be possibly spiritual thriller.
It would be mainstream or metaphysical in the bookstores. I call it a spiritual thriller. You can actually go to my website, popeannalisa.com. That's one word, popeannalisa.com. It has a wealth of information and videos about some of the subject matters that we've talked about, a little bit more descriptive of the book. And if you can't find the book in your bookstore, you can order it through Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Borders. Any of the major bookstores can order the book for you.
The other thing about it, though, is that it's well-crafted, so it should be more like literary fiction, because those are also your priorities, and you've published in literary journal. If you're interested in seeing something different, have a read. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for having me.